Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to our Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from the Cubberley Center in Palo Alto. My name is Dr. Meredith Rudolph. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Michio Kaku, best-selling author of Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Lives by the Year 2010. This book is number 7 now on the New York Times bestseller list. Born in San Jose, Dr. Kaku earned his bachelor's degree from Harvard University and his PhD from the University of California, Berkeley. He is currently a professor of theoretical physics at the City College of New York, where he has taught for over 25 years. A highly regarded member of the science community, Dr. Kaku is co-founder of the string field theory and continues Einstein's search for a theory of everything to unite the four fundamental forces of the universe into one unified theory. He is the best-selling author of several books, including Physics of the Impossible and Hyperspace. He's hosted several television shows for the BBC, the Discovery Channel, the History Channel, and the Science Channel. You can hear Dr. Kaku on the radio as host of two nationally syndicated weekly programs, Explorations in Science and Science Fantastic. And if that isn't enough, he was just named by New York Magazine as one of the 100 most intelligent people in New York. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Michio Kaku.
Well, after such a great introduction, I can't wait to hear the speaker myself. First of all, let me say that I have a confession to make. It's true that New York Magazine voted me as one of the 100 smartest people in New York, but in all fairness, I have to admit that Madonna made that same list. So how authoritative could that list be? Now, today, I'm going to give you a guided tour through the future as told to me by 300 of the world's top scientists that I've interviewed for BBC Television, Science Channel, Discovery Channel, and my own radio show, which goes out to 140 cities across the United States. Now, prediction, of course, is very difficult. Let me quote from that great philosopher of the Western world, Yogi Berra. Yogi Berra once said, quote, "Prediction is awfully hard to do, especially if it's about the future." But I'm a physicist. We invented the laser. We invented the transistor. We helped to create the first computer. We wrote the World Wide Web. We created television, radio, radar. We created the MRI machine. We created the space program. We created the GPS system. And now we physicists are inventing the 21st century. And we physicists love to make predictions. When the internet was created, one physicist predicted that the internet would become a forum of high art, high society, and high culture. Well, today we know that 5% of the internet is pornography. But that's because teenage boys log on to the internet. Just wait until the grandmas and grandpas log on to the internet. Then 50% of the internet will be pornography. So, in my life, I've had twin passions, two role models. First, when Einstein died, everyone was talking about the fact that he couldn't finish his greatest achievement. And I said to myself, well, hey, I mean, why couldn't he finish it? I mean, it was a homework assignment, right? Why didn't he ask his mother? I mean, what's the big deal? Well, the big deal was it was supposed to be the theory of everything. An equation 1 inch long that would, quote, read the mind of God, unquote. And I said to myself, that's for me. That's what I want to work on. But I had another role model. On Saturdays, I used to turn on TV and watch Flash Gordon. Rocket ships, aliens, cities in the sky. I said to myself, whoa, that's for me too. But then I began to realize something. First, I didn't have muscles and blonde hair. But it was the scientists who made it work. The scientist who invented the rocket ship, the spaceships, the ray gun, the invisibility shield. And then I began to realize something very important. And that is, science, especially physics, is the key to the future. You cannot build rocket ships. You cannot have invisibility shields. You cannot have ray guns unless you understand the physics behind it. So, when I was in high school, in fact, this high school, this is where I graduated from in 1964. So this is a homecoming of sorts. So back then, I went to my mom, and I said, Mom, can I have permission to build an atom smasher in the garage? A 2.3 million electron volt betatron particle accelerator. And my mom kind of like looked at me and said, sure, why not? And don't forget to take out the garbage. So I went to Westinghouse. I went to Varian Associates. I got 400 pounds of transformer steel that I cut just about 20 feet from here in the machine shop. I got 22 miles of copper wire that I wound on the football field just about 100 feet from here. I put 22 miles of copper wire on the goalpost, really heavy. I gave it to my mother, and she ran to the 50-yard line and gave it to my father. And then my father would run to the other goalpost, and we wound 22 miles of copper wire right over there on the high school football field. Well, finally, it was ready. It consumed 6 kilowatts of power, raw power. The magnetic field was 20,000 times the Earth's magnetic field. If you got too close to my machine, in principle, it could rip the fillings out of your teeth if you got too close. Finally, it was ready. I closed my eyes, I shut my ears, I turned on the machine, and I heard this huge crackling sound as 6 kilowatts of raw power surged through my atom smasher. And then I heard this pop, pop, pop sound as I blew out all the circuit breakers in the house. Well, the house was plunged in darkness, and my poor mom, she come home, and then she would see the lights flicker and die. And she must have thought to herself, why couldn't I have a son who plays basketball? Maybe if I buy him a football. And for God's sake, why can't he find a nice Japanese girlfriend? I mean, why does he build these machines in the garage? Well, hey, I'll be frank. That machine got me into Harvard. And that began my career as a theoretical physicist. So before I begin talking about the next 100 years, let me also begin with telling you a morality tale. Over 200 years ago, we had the great French Revolution. And one day, there were three men about to lose their head to the guillotine. There was a priest, a lawyer, and a theoretical physicist, just like me, about to have our heads cut off. Well, they put the priest's head on the chopping block, and they asked him, do you have any last words before we slice your head off? And the priest said, yes. He said, God above shall certainly set me free. Well, all eyes were on the blade. They raised the blade. And the blade came down, swish, and stopped right before it hit the neck of the priest. Well, the crowd had never seen this before. They were marveled and startled and said, let the priest go. God has spoken today. And now let's see about the lawyer. Yes, the lawyer. Well, they put the lawyer's head on the chopping block. And they asked him, do you have any last words? And the lawyer said, yes. Maybe the spirit of justice. Yes, justice shall shut me free. Well, all eyes were on the blade. They raised the blade. The blade came down, swish, and stopped right before it hit the neck of the lawyer. Well, this time there was dancing in the streets of Paris. People were saying, God has spoken today. Justice and mercy have spoken today. Let there be a holiday. And now let's see about that theoretical physicist. Well, they put the physicist's head on the chopping block and they asked him, do you have any last words? And he said, yeah, I got some last words. And he said, you know, I don't know too much about God. And I know even less about the law, but I do know one thing. If you look up, you'll see that the rope is stuck on the pulley. And then he said, if you remove the rope, the blade should come down real good. Big mistake. Well, the rope came down, the blade came down, and the poor physicist's head came down. And it just goes to show you that sometimes we physicists have to know when to keep our mouths shut. But nonetheless, let me now give you a guided tour through the future, because we physicists love to make predictions. In fact, we can predict out to billions of years in the future. My colleague Stephen Hawking likes to talk about trillions of years in the future. So let me quote now from that other great philosopher of the Western world, Woody Allen. Woody Allen once said, quote, eternity is an awful long time, especially toward the end. Now, my last book, Physics of the Impossible, is now a TV series on the Science Channel, 24 episodes. Psychokinesis, telepathy, star travel, time travel, wormholes, warp drive, everything you've ever dreamed of in science fiction is explained in Physics of the Impossible. But after I did Physics of the Impossible, I wanted to write a book about us, about the next 20, 50, the next 100 years. What will the future foretell? And I had a role model here. Back in 1863, Jules Verne talks about the Earth to the moon. And you know something? He got the size of the space capsule right to within about 10% accuracy. He said Florida will be the place where we launch the moon rocket. It would take 3 days to go to the moon, and it would come back and splash down in the ocean. He got everything right except the propulsion system, because rockets wouldn't be invented for many a decade. But some people would say that's a fluke. He got lucky. Jules Verne, he got lucky predicting the next 100 years. Well, in 1863, he wrote another novel about the next 100 years in Paris. It was called Paris in the 20th Century, Paris in 1960. The book was so preposterous, so incredible, so fantastic, they couldn't publish it. Who was going to believe him predicting Paris 100 years from now? So what did Jules Verne predict that was so incredible no one would believe it? In a time when most people lived in shacks, he predicted glass skyscrapers. In a time when long distance travel meant getting on a horse, if you were rich, he predicted gasoline-fired automobiles. And long-distance telecommunications. In an era when long-distance telecommunication was yelling at your neighbor, he predicted fax machines. He predicted something like the Internet. How could he get it so accurate? Because every time a scientist would come through Paris, he would sit down with them, pump them for information. He was well-versed in all the sciences of 1863. So I said to myself, why don't I interview all the top scientists who are inventing the future in their laboratory? Nobody can predict the future. The best you can do is interview the people who are building the future in their laboratories. So let's do an imaginary experiment. Let's imagine the world of 1900. What would the world of 1900 look like to our grandparents and our great-grandparents? How would they view us? Well, let's be blunt about this. Life expectancy back in 1900 was in the 40s. You were born, you grow up, and you died. Life was a bitch. Most people were dirt farmers back then. High tech meant the telegraph if you were rich. Long distance travel meant the horse if you had money. This is how people lived in 1900. Now, let's say that they could see you right now. You have rockets, car engines with 200 horsepower, atomic bombs, and an electrification of the entire planet. How would your grandparents view you today? They would say that you are a wizard, a sorcerer. Rockets and jet planes and electricity and bombs. Sorcerer. Now let's do another experiment. Let's say that you could talk to your children, grandkids and great-grandkids of the year 2100. How would you view them? Remember that science accelerates. Science is not progressing linearly. It's accelerating. The amount of knowledge that we can create doubles every roughly 10 years. You can see that in any college science library. How would you view your own flesh and blood living in the year 2100? You would view them as gods. The gods of mythology. Remember in high school we learned about the gods of mythology? In high school we learned about Zeus. He would think of something and it would come to be. By thinking, he could create objects, move objects. And there are perks being a god. Venus is a perk. You'd have a perfect body. Who wouldn't want to have a perfect body? An ageless body. And then Apollo on the lower left had a chariot. Yes, we will have flying cars by 2100, finally. And on the lower right is Pegasus. We see that flying horses, animals that are beyond today's technology, are also a possibility. Now, Arthur C. Clarke, the science fiction writer, once said that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. But what I'm going to try to tell you today is that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from divinity. So let's talk about how this will come about. And let's be blunt about this. When you learn about Greek mythology, you learn that most of the gods were fools. They spent their time creating mischief. In fact, Loki was the god of mischief, and he helped to bring down heaven, Ragnarok, the twilight of the gods. So when we have the power of the gods, will we also have the wisdom of Solomon to wield this enormous power? So let's talk about this. First of all, let's predict what a computer will look like in the next 10, 20 years, 50 years, and 100 years. There's something called Moore's Law, which simply says that computer power doubles every 18 months. That's very simple, right? But the wealth of America, the power of America, is manifested in this very simple chart. On a log scale, it's a straight line. Computer power doubles every 18 months. This means that when you get a birthday card and you open it up, it sings happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. There's a chip in that card. That chip has more computer power than all the Allied forces of 1945. Hitler, Eisenhower, Churchill would have killed to get that chip. And what do you do with it? You throw it away. In 2020, computer chips will be about 1,000 times cheaper, more powerful than they are today, which means that a chip will cost about a penny. So ask yourself a simple question. Where do we find electricity today? Electricity is in the floor, in the walls, in the ceiling. Electricity is everywhere and nowhere. Where's running water? Running water is under our feet, in the walls, in the ceiling. It's everywhere and nowhere. And how do you pay for it? You meter it. You meter electricity, which is invisible, and you meter running water. That's the future of the computer. The computer will disappear. It'll go into the fabric of our life. It'll be everywhere and nowhere. And we will meter it in the cloud. So, and then after 2020, this curve collapses. Moore's Law will collapse, which means that Silicon Valley could become a rust belt in 2020. It's a cautionary tale. I'll talk about the collapse of Moore's Law in a minute. But every decade, we have a revolution. In the 60s, computers were mainframe. Huge, gigantic military banking computers, the size of a room. In the 70s, computers were mini computers, the size of this podium. That's what a computer looked like in the 70s. In the 80s, it was a PC. In the 90s, the internet dominated our discussion. Then in the 2000s, it was ubiquitous computing. Chips left the computer. When a chip goes into a telephone, it becomes a cell phone. When a chip goes into a typewriter, it becomes a word processor. So ubiquitous computing is when chips disappear into the environment. And in 2010, in that decade, we will have advanced sensors, sensors that can detect cancer 10 years before a cancer forms. And beyond that, the power of a god, mind control over computers. So the internet, let's talk about what the internet will look like in the future. First of all, the internet of the future in the next 10 years will be in your glasses. Your glasses will have the ability to recognize people's faces. So when you bump into somebody, you will no longer have to say, who is this person? It's Jim, John, Jake, I know this person. Who is this person? Your glasses will say, it's Jim, stupid. Remember, how many times do I have to tell you? It's Jim. You met him last year at last year's conference. And then if your friend speaks Chinese, no problem. Your glasses will translate Chinese into English as they speak. This is almost available today. So internet glasses will be trendy in the future. You don't have to look like a refugee from Star Trek. They'll be sexy. Kids will say, what? You don't have the latest internet glasses? You can't download the movies you want in your glasses? Models will begin to show off internet glasses. They'll be an artifact of high fashion. This is the future of your home office, the future of your home entertainment center. Now, there's a problem here. Let's say you don't wear glasses. What do you do? If you don't wear glasses, you put them in your contact lens. In the future, when you have the internet in your contact lens, you blink and you will go online. And who will buy these contact lens first? College students taking final examinations. They will love these things. They'll line up to get these contact lens. What? You have to memorize all the sines and cosines? What? You have to memorize all the amino acids? Well, why bother? You can look them up anyway. So concepts are important. Principles are important, not memorizing all the sines and cosines. So you simply blink, and you will go online. So the first people to buy these will be students taking exams. The second people to buy these things will be artists. Because you'll be able to create anything you want with your hands by simply waving your hands. Gorgeous sculptures, works of art. So, and who will also buy these contact lenses? Architects. Today, if you're an architect, it takes weeks to build models of your apartment house and towers and buildings. And if you want to change it, forget it. It's going to take another few weeks to rearrange all the units. In the future, you'll simply blink and rearrange these things with your hand. In other words, for you Star Trek fans out there, this is the holodeck. You'll be able to recreate any kind of environment by simply blinking. Tourists will love these things because today when you go to Rome, there's really not much of the Roman Empire left. So in the future, tourists will blink and see the entire Roman Empire resurrected in their contact lens as they walk through the streets of Rome. The Chinese are taking a huge step in this direction. Outside Beijing, there's the Summer Palace, and the Summer Palace is now being animated. So as you walk along the grounds of the Summer Palace, you see what it looked like back in the 1800s before it was burned by the French and the British. The military is looking into this. I had a demonstration of this. I flew down to Fort Benning, Georgia with a film crew from the Science Channel. I put on a helmet, and there's a little tiny eyepiece I flipped the eyepiece over to my eye, and there was a complete battlefield. Friendly forces, enemy forces, airplanes, all of it in my eyepiece. The internet of the battlefield, right there. So I tell you, man, this is going to be big. Now, virtual reality is for children. Children love virtual reality because they can fight against aliens and flying saucers and stuff like that. Adults will have augmented reality. This is how we will live in the next 10, 20 years. Augmented reality is when you impose virtual information on top of reality, so you will always know who you are talking to, because the biography of the person appears. This is really handy. Let's say you're looking for a job, and there's a cocktail party, and some real heavy hitters are at that cocktail party, but you don't know who they are. In the future, you will know exactly who to suck up to at any cocktail party. Now, you've seen this before. You may say to yourself, now, wait a minute. I've seen this augmented reality before. Where have I seen it before? Well, this is the governor of California in a very bad mood. Arnold Schwarzenegger was the Terminator. And remember how the Terminator would find his prey? His eyepiece would lock onto John Connor and then print out his biography. Print out information. That's how we will live in the future. You will always know what you're looking at, who you're talking to, what they are saying, because it's translated and interpreted on the fly. So the uses of this are enormous. Not only can you see people's biographies, subtitles, you also have X-ray vision. Let's say you are a fighter pilot on a very expensive aircraft, and then the enemy jet flies underneath you. At that point, you are blind. You're blind and you're dead meat because the enemy is now beneath you and behind you. In the future, we will put a TV camera underneath the airplane. The TV camera will shoot the image into your contact lens and you will see right through your own legs. This is X-ray vision. Tourists will love it because you can resurrect ancient tourist sites. Prospectors, soldiers, astronauts, they'll find this indispensable supervision, augmented reality. This is the Matrix. We will live very much in a world similar to the movie, The Matrix, except you're not going to be able to jack into the back of your brain and learn karate. You're still going to have to learn karate the old-fashioned way. So, when chips leap out of a PC and they jump into things, where can they jump into? When a chip jumps into your wristwatch, it becomes an internet wristwatch. We can put the entire internet on your wristwatch. When a chip jumps into a telephone, it becomes a cell phone. But we all know that the cell phone has a teensy-weensy little keyboard. If you have fat fingers, you're out of luck. In the future, you will simply scroll out of your cell phone intelligent paper. A huge, intelligent, flexible screen comes out with a gigantic keyboard because you will have intelligent paper. This is called flexible paper. It is intelligent. Every dot on the screen is a transistor, an organic light-emitting diode. So this is the future of the cell phone. And this is the future of wallpaper. You know, our grandkids will wonder, how could grandma and grandpa live in a world where everything was dumb? Everything was stupid. Wallpaper was wallpaper. You couldn't yell at it. You couldn't talk to wallpaper. Well, intelligent wallpaper is coming. It's flexible. It has the power of chips because chips only cost a penny. Have you ever tried to remove wallpaper from a room? I did once. I'll never do it again in my life. I learned my lesson. Never try to remove wallpaper. You have to get a pot of hot boiling water, pour it on the wallpaper to dissolve the glue behind the wallpaper. I'll never do that again. In the future, you'll simply go to the wall and say, "Wall, change color." Redecorating a house has never been as simple. And the upper left is your wallet of the future, where pictures will move in your wallet. Today, pictures in your wallet just do nothing. They just sit there looking stupid. In the future, your pictures in your wallet will move because chips only cost a penny. and your living room of the future. What will your living room look like? We will have 360-degree wall screens surrounding us. And this will also change our love life. Let's say you're a college student on Friday night and you have no date. We all know what you do. You get stone drunk. In the future, you'll go to the wall screen, and you'll say, "Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's available tonight?" The wall screen will then contact all the other people who are staring lonely at their wall screens and set up a date for you, because the wall screen already knows the kind of people you like. And then you'll go to a movie, and then you'll come back, and then you say, "Mirror, mirror on the wall, my date and I want to see Casablanca, except remove Humphrey Bogart's face and put my face instead. Remove Ingrid Bergman's face and put my date's face instead." Now, some people don't like the internet because they say it's cold, mechanical, frightening. Some people don't like technology because they don't want to be left behind because it's dehumanizing to them. Well, yeah, when the internet was first created, the internet was not created by the Pentagon just so that teenagers can Facebook each other. That's not the reason why the Pentagon created the internet. It was a military weapon. Male-dominated, hierarchical military weapon to win a war against Russia. It was male. Now, the internet is female. It is 51% female. In fact, it's about touching people. It's no longer about dominating over the Soviet Union, because there is no Soviet Union. In 1989, as the Soviet bloc was breaking up, the National Science Foundation took this internet and gave it away for free. A military weapon given away for free, and that changed world history. So today, the internet is female. It's about touching people. So when we have an intelligent living room, 360-degree wall screen, we'll use it to set up bridge games and hobbies with people around the world. You will never be lonely in the future. Today, when you're old, your kids don't visit you anymore, you're in an old age home all by yourself, why bother to be lonely when you can touch people? Now, chips are going everywhere. They're going into toys now. That's causing a problem for the English language when chips go into toys. We have a contradiction in terms called smart Barbie dolls. Another contradiction in terms is Microsoft Works. That is also a contradiction in terms. So when chips leap out of computers and go into everywhere, they're also going to go into your window. Yes, glass will be intelligent. Let's say you have a room with a view. You see the junkyard behind the building. Why bother to suffer looking at that junkyard every day? In the future, you'll go to the window and say, "Mirror, mirror on my wall, turn into something else." So I'll see the Taj Mahal. I'll see a lake. I'll see the Eiffel Tower instead of the junkyard that's behind my room. Yes, it turns out that windows will become intelligent. And TV sets will have 3D movies without glasses. Without those clunky glasses. How does that work? A TV screen has many vertical lines. Each vertical line is a prism. This vertical line, which is a prism, splits an image in half. One half goes to your left eye, one half goes to your right eye, and that's how you get 3D television without glasses. And what about the office of the future? We will have penny disposable scrap computers. Scrap computer, that sounds impossible, right? How can a computer be scrap unless it's obsolete? Because chips will cost a penny. Therefore, you'll scribble on something and throw it away. As you go from room to room, the scribble follows you. Your files follow you as you throw away all these disposable computers because your software is in the cloud. Software becomes more important than hardware because hardware is disposable. So in the future, your office will have disposable computers. And your cubicle. Your cubicle of the future will be gorgeous. 360-degree paneling. In fact, your cubicle will be so gorgeous, you'll never get any work done. And cars of the future will be driverless. Cars will have no driver because GPS will take over and guide your car. Driverless cars already exist. In fact, I had a chance to drive one. BBC Television put me in this car. And so here I was, two hands on the steering wheel, driving this car. And then the cameraman said, okay, let go. And I said, what? Let go, he said. So I let go of the steering wheel, and the car drove itself. So here's a homework assignment for tonight. Go home tonight and drive your car looking like this, holding your two arms out, not touching the steering wheel. Well, that's how we'll do it. And there's radar in the fender, and this is actually safer than a human being. You see, human beings get drunk. Human beings fall asleep. Human beings like to drag race. Human beings like to show off. Computers don't show off. They never get drunk. They never fall asleep. So these computer-guided cars, driverless cars, are actually safer than human beings. Now, that was the next 10 to 20 years, when chips escape, go into the environment, and change our life. What happens now mid-century with computers? By mid-century, computers are so powerful that we will control them with the mind. On the lower left is Surrogates, the movie Surrogates with Bruce Willis. That was a movie where we mentally controlled robots. And then, of course, is Avatar, where we mentally control clones. So telepathy and telekinesis, they are the power of a god. Only gods can read your mind. Only gods can move objects with their mind until the computer revolution. With the computer revolution, we can now make toys that read your mind. Boys or girls can put a little helmet on their head, which interprets radio signals, which are emitted by the brain, and then from that, energize toys. This reminds me of one of my favorite Star Trek episodes. In Star Trek, they land on a planet where there is a god, Apollo, the Greek god. The crew of the Enterprise are overwhelmed because 23rd century technology is useless against a god. But then they say to themselves, now wait a minute. There's no such thing as a god. This guy must have a power source. So they locate the power source. He mentally controls the power source. And then the power source does all the magic tricks. They destroy the power source, and Apollo, the god, becomes immortal. That's how we're going to do it. All of us will have a power source. We'll access it mentally, and it'll carry out our wishes. How does it work? You can put a chip in somebody's brain, somebody who's paralyzed, in fact. That chip is connected to a laptop computer, and eventually that person can manipulate the laptop, answer emails, even if he's paralyzed, write emails, surf the web, even if he is totally immobilized. Yes, at Brown University, they can take a stroke victim who is, for all intents and purposes, a vegetable, cannot communicate, tremendous brain damage. They put a chip in his brain, connected the chip to a laptop computer, and this person can now surf the web, do crossword puzzles, have emails, answer emails, write emails, and he's paralyzed. And in Japan, they are even go farther than that. You can take a human, put sensors on the human's head that understand the brain patterns, and hook it up to a robot. This is the movie Surrogates, starring Bruce Willis, a human controlling a robot. Now, unfortunately, we don't have these in Japan now, cleaning up the reactor accident. Wouldn't it be great if we had these robots mentally controlled by a worker that could go into high lethal radiation fields to make repairs? We don't have that today. This is still experimental. If we had them today, we could clean up the mess in Japan very rapidly, but we don't have them operational today. We can also use them as a form of mind reading to a degree. On the left, you see a brain that is normal telling the truth. When you tell the truth, the brain doesn't light up under MRI scans. But when you tell a lie, first you have to know the truth, then you have to create the lie, and then you have to calculate the consistency of the lie with all the other lies you've been telling all these years. That's a lot of brain power. Your mind lights up like a Christmas tree. But we can also create a dictionary of thought. When you see a cat, a dog, they create different patterns, and computers can recognize these patterns. So it's going to take a while. By mid-century, we'll have it, the ability to think of something and have our wish comes true. But there's also a morality tale. When I was a kid, there was a movie called Forbidden Planet. It was a great movie. It was about a movie concerning a race of super beings called the Krell. They created a machine that would make them a god, a machine that would materialize any wish. They dream about ice cream, the machine would materialize ice cream, anything you wanted. They could materialize robots. They could materialize images. And then on the very day they turned on their machine that would turn them into a god, they all died. Every single one of them. They all died the very day they turned on a machine which would grant them the power of a god. What happened? In the final scene, you find out what happened. What happened was, when they turned on the machine, they fell asleep. And they had nightmares. And the nightmares became real. And these nightmares meant collective suicide as monsters ripped all these people apart. So I guess the lesson here is, if we have a machine that gives us the power of a god, for God's sake, don't fall asleep. And let's say a few things about medicine. You know that movie Fantastic Voyage, when they shrink Raquel Welch and they put Raquel Welch in your blood? The reviewers hated that movie. What? Waste Raquel Welch by shrinking her and putting inside your blood? But, you know, we're going to have this. It's called nanotechnology. And the question is, how small can you make a computer? Well, we can make a computer so small that you can put it inside an aspirin pill to create a smart pill. A smart pill has a TV camera, a chip, a radio, and a magnet. With a magnet, you can guide it down your stomach into your intestines. And this gives new meaning for the expression, Intel inside. So how small can you make one of these tools? We can make particles the size of molecules called nanoparticles, and they can kill cancer cells. This is big. This is real big. Smart bombs that can specifically target individual cancer cells. I had dinner with one of the women pioneering this technology. 90% effectiveness against certain tumors. This is going to make chemotherapy look like torture. You know, when we think about medicine of the past, like they had bloodletting and leeches in the past, and that's how George Washington died. Many people wonder, well, how did the father of our country die? And the answer is, he was murdered. He was killed by his doctors. You know, doctors, they bury their mistakes. They bled him alive. They bled George Washington, because in those days they thought that bad blood meant you had to remove the blood. And that's how he died. He bled to death. Well, chemotherapy it works to a degree. But chemotherapy makes you vomit, your hair falls out, it's horrible. In the future, we will have smart bombs. We've tested them. They work. But it'll take many years to show they work against all cancers and get FDA approval. But this is the future. This is big, real big, a new form of therapy that attacks cancer at the molecular level. And then how will we diagnose cancer? We will diagnose cancer with your toilet. Ladies and gentlemen, the cure for cancer could be your toilet, because your toilet will analyze your proteins and tell you that you eat too much sugar, too much salt. Isn't the future wonderful? Even your toilet will tell you that you eat too much. But these toilets will also analyze proteins. Proteins emitted from cancer colonies of maybe 100. Now, today, when you feel a lump in your breast, it's too late. They don't tell you this. It's really too late. You have 10 billion cancer cells growing inside your breast. Surgery is required immediately. In the future, your toilet will pick up proteins emitted from 100 cancer cells and say, watch out, you should do something about it in 10 years. For example, you know that Aretha Franklin is suffering from pancreatic cancer, a vicious, fatal form of cancer. Steve Jobs, founder of Apple, is apparently suffering from pancreatic cancer. Patrick Swayze, the actor who did Dirty Dancing, he died of pancreatic cancer. All textbooks say the pancreatic cancer kills very rapidly in roughly 2 years or so. Very aggressive, very dangerous. We now know that that's totally wrong. We've now taken the DNA of pancreatic cancer, sequenced it to find its secrets. We now know that it's a very slow-growing cancer. 20 years it grows. But only in the last 2 years does it create symptoms that you feel. And then it's really too late. So pancreatic cancer is actually a slow-growing cancer. So in the future, your toilet will pick up proteins emitted from pancreatic cancer and tell you, watch out, you have 20 years to remove this cancer. What I'm trying to tell you is something very simple. The word tumor could disappear from the English language. How will we do it? These are DNA chips, one of the hottest things in the medical field, using the technology of Silicon Valley to identify molecules, to identify proteins, to identify DNA fragments of cancer decades before they form a tumor. I tell you, man, this is big. This is really big. Nanotechnology to zap cancer cells and DNA chips to detect them decades before they become a threat. And remember Star Trek when they had tricorders? You simply wave this little box and Spock would say, oh, you have this disease, you have that disease. Most critics said, ha, no way. How can this little box see inside your body? How can this little box diagnose disease? No way. Well, believe it or not, it's coming. On the left, you see an MRI machine, a huge, gigantic machine the size of a room. The guy who invented it, Paul Ernst, was actually my boss at Varian Associates. I had a summer job at Varian Associates. The guy who supervised me won the Nobel Prize for the MRI machine. The smallest MRI machine today is the size of a purse. And in Germany, where they make this machine, they say that the smallest MRI machine will be the size of a cell phone. That's the tricorder. We will have a tricorder in the future. And then, of course, DNA is the code of life. Today, it costs $50,000 to sequence all the genes in your body. $50,000. But in the future, it'll cost maybe $100 to have an owner's manual for your body. You know, in your living room, you have an owner's manual for your VCR, for your stereo, for your TV set, your laptop. You have an owner's manual for everything in your living room except one thing. You. You have no owner's manual. Well, here it's coming. And with that owner's manual, you will be able to see all your genes displayed, telling you the propensity for all the different diseases. And what are you going to do with this knowledge? One thing you will do is replace organs as they wear out. One of the perks of being a god is, as body parts wear out, you simply replace them. After all, you are a god. This is an ear. It's made out of plastic. It looks like an ear, but it's like a sponge. If you see this special sponge with ear cells will proliferate inside this mold, and eventually the plastic will dissolve, leaving a perfect ear. From your own cells, we can now grow bone, cartilage, noses, ears, blood vessels, heart valves. The first bladder was grown 4 years ago. A young girl had a misshapen bladder. A bladder was grown from her own cells to replace her misshapen bladder. The first windpipe was grown just last year, a full-blown windpipe. In 5 years' time, we hope to grow the first liver from your own cells. So for all you alcoholics out there, take heart. We will grow livers. Remember, Mickey Mantle died of liver cancer. Liver failure, cirrhosis of the liver. We will grow livers. Now, let me try to wind up because I have to take a few questions and answers, and then I'll sign your books. But let me also say that genetically, we can also isolate the gene that makes a smart mouse. The smart mouse, well, usually mice are kind of timid, but a smart mouse, maybe they can read Scientific American. Who knows? But we have a counterpart to the smart mouse gene. The smart mouse gene allows mice to go really quick through a maze. They have better memory. And there's also the mighty mouse gene. Genes that make mice muscle bound. Now, we found the counterpart of that in Germany. There was a young German boy who had the same mighty mouse gene. So we couldn't call it the mighty mouse gene, that gene that allows you to be muscle bound. We now call it the Schwarzenegger gene. And this is causing a problem for the Olympics because it's very difficult to detect the Schwarzenegger gene. And let me wind up, but let me say a few things. First of all, the aging process is now being deciphered and worked out at the genetic molecular level. Did you know that we are 98.5% identical to a chimpanzee at the genetic level? But we live twice as long. Therefore, among a handful of genes are the genes that doubled our lifespan. This is big. It means that at some point or other, we will find the genes that control the aging process. For example, when everyone has a CD-ROM with our genes on it, we'll scan the genes of millions of old people, scan the genes of millions of young people, and subtract. We'll find exactly where aging takes place. Now, we know genetically that different animals live different lifespans. Did you know that an alligator or a crocodile has no known finite lifespan? They apparently live forever. But you might say to yourself, now, wait a minute, that's not true. Textbooks say that alligators and crocodiles live to be the age of 70. No, that's when the zookeeper died. Apparently, alligators and crocodiles never age. I spoke in South Africa once, and I talked to the gamekeeper, and he said, oh, absolutely. His crocodiles are just as virile and active at 70 as they were at 3. They never seem to age. Now, of course, they eventually do die of starvation, die of accidents. But apparently, no one has ever seen an alligator or crocodile die of old age. So, in my book, I make hundreds of predictions, every single one based on a prototype, a demonstration of principle, because I'm not a science fiction writer. I want hard-nosed facts. And aging is going to be one of the areas of enormous research at the genetic level. This means that maybe our grandkids may live to be the age of 30 and decide to stop aging. They may just want to cruise at age of 30 for many a decade. Well, let me end on one final note, because the book has hundreds of predictions, but I have to sign your book. Let me say that when I was a kid, my childhood hero was Albert Einstein, and I spoke at his Einstein Centennial, and my favorite Einstein story is this. When Einstein was an old man, he was tired of giving the same talk over and over again. So one day his chauffeur came up to him, and the chauffeur said, "Professor, I'm also a part-time actor. I've heard your speech so many times, I've memorized it like an actor. So why don't we switch places? I will put on a mustache and a wig. I will be the great Einstein, and you can take a rest and be my chauffeur." Well, Einstein loved the joke, so they switched places. This went on beautifully. He was an actor, after all, until one day somebody asked a very difficult question in the back. And Einstein thought, "Oh, the game is up." But then the chauffeur said, "That question is so elementary that even my chauffeur here can answer it for you." Thank you very much. You've been a great audience.
Thank you, Dr. Kaku, for sharing your insights with us. My name is John Zipperer, Vice President of Media and Editorial at the Commonwealth Club, and I'll be moderating this evening's question and answer session. Let me begin by asking, do you think that airplane travel will change dramatically over the next 50 years?
Air travel will become more efficient, more energy efficient, but basically the same. However, other things will change, like flying cars. We will have flying cars. Well, first of all, we already have flying cars, but they're really expensive. Fuel mileage is horrible because you have two gigantic rotors and you just burn up gasoline as if it was like water. However, magnets hover for free without any addition of energy at all. Hovering is for free with magnets. In the future, we will have something called room temperature superconducting magnets. Magnets that are super magnets at room temperature. At that point, we will have flying cars, and we will have what every young kid wants, a hoverboard. We will have these things. And what about jetpacks? People say, where's my jetpack, for God's sake? You guys promised me a jetpack, right? Wrong. Physicists never promised jetpacks. Science fiction writers wanted jetpacks for everybody, so we're not liable for their mistakes. We know that hydrogen peroxide is the fuel for jetpacks. The Nazis during World War II used jetpacks to zip across rivers where the bridges were bombed. So jetpacks are very common, especially in warfare, but the hydrogen peroxide only lasts for about 2 minutes. 2 minutes and you go down. You saw the movie Thunderball where Sean Connery had a jetpack on for many minutes. They had to splice many scenes together to get Sean Connery in a jetpack. So in the future, when we have nanobatteries, tremendous concentrated energy in a nanobattery, then we may have jetpacks that are practical. But again, we physicists never promised you jetpacks or flying cars.
We have a question about energy, but I want to first take it to something you've been in the news discussing quite a bit lately, and that is the situation in Japan with the nuclear crisis. Could you give us an update on where it is now and maybe what you think is happening next?
Well, the reactors are hanging by a thread right now. If you've been reading the stories, radiation levels are near lethal in Unit 2. If you stand near the radioactive water in Unit 2, you will come down with enough radiation in 1 hour to give you radiation sickness, hemorrhaging, vomiting, nausea, just 1 hour at that reactor. If you stay for 6 hours, the first deaths will start. So radiation levels are near lethal. But where is the radiation coming from? We think it's coming from core damage, which also means there's probably a crack in the containment structure and the vessel, allowing radioactive water to go into the environment. We're not sure, because it's so radioactive, no human can go in for very long to take pictures to tell us what's happening there. So there's a best case scenario and a worst case scenario. The best case scenario is that the brave firemen can keep shooting hose water to keep the core and the spent fuel ponds covered with water at any given time. That's the best case scenario. Then it'll take a few years to clean up the mess. That's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is that radiation escalates. Workers have to evacuate. It's too dangerous for workers to work there. Then you're in free fall. Without the firemen shooting hose water into the reactors, the reactor heats up, boils off its water, and then exposed, you have a hydrogen gas explosion or a steam explosion that blows the whole thing apart, and then it's Chernobyl all over again. So the nightmare could even be worse than Chernobyl. We have 3 nuclear power stations that are in various stages of melting down. So my solution to the problem is do what Gorbachev did in 1986. Gorbachev, realizing that the utility people could not handle the crisis, called out the Red Air Force. And they buried the sucker in sand, concrete, and boric acid. 5,000 tons worth. I would suggest that the Prime Minister of Japan remove the utility from leadership, bring in the Japanese Air Force with helicopters and sand and boric acid and concrete, and bury the reactors in a sarcophagus of concrete. That's the last resort, but I think we're coming close to that last resort pretty soon.
When you say bury the reactors, you mean the three that are in the biggest danger, or there are, what, six reactors at that plant?
There are four reactors that are dangerous, three which are operating, we're operating, yeah. And one is a spent fuel pond,
okay.
Four. Those four units, I think, if it spins out of control, if the workers have to evacuate and the reactor situation is in free fall, I suggest that they exercise this option and bury the whole thing in concrete. It works.
Well, obviously people have been reevaluating nuclear power very much since this first camp happened. And one of our members of the audience asks, what alternative sources of producing energy do you support?
Well, nuclear energy is the Faustian bargain. That is, Faust was the mythical figure who sold his soul to the devil for unlimited power. The Japanese have made that Faustian bargain. They don't have much oil, they don't have much coal, they don't have much hydro. Mm. So they've thrown the dice with nuclear energy, but they fooled themselves in terms of how dangerous nuclear energy potentially is. Now, when I was in high school, here in this high school, I went to the National Science Fair, and there was a nuclear scientist who immediately took a liking to me, immediately knew what I was doing with my antimatter experiments, and took me under his wing and offered me a scholarship to Harvard. That nuclear scientist was Edward Teller. He was my advisor in high school and in college. And Edward Teller was famous for saying, nuclear power, that's the way to go. But nuclear power is so potentially dangerous, it does not belong on the surface of the earth. It belongs underground. Because if that reactor were underground, you just put a manhole cover on it and walk away from it. Well, that's impractical today. So we're stuck with these reactors. We have two of them in California. One of them, San Onofre, near an earthquake fault. And the other, Diablo Canyon, also near an earthquake fault. Mm-hmm. And I live in Manhattan. 13 miles north of me is the Indian Point nuclear power plant. I was on the David Letterman show last Monday, and I was shocked. David Letterman goes into this tirade denouncing the Indian Point nuclear power plant. Later, I figured out why. He lives right next to it. So not in my backyard. He lives in Westchester, very pricey area, which is very close to Peekskill, where we have one of the most dangerous nuclear power plants in the country, says the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. If they had a chance to relicense that reactor today, they would not give it a license. That's how potentially dangerous the Indian Point reactor is.
So how long do we have to wait until there is a safe, highly productive alternative? Or is there already that you would like to see us put our energy into?
Well, fossil fuels are quite efficient. Pound for pound, oil and gasoline has more energy than a car battery, because gasoline represents concentrated sunlight since the time of the dinosaurs. Very efficient. But every year, fossil fuels go up in price because it's erratic and we're dependent on the Middle East. But solar hydrogen go down every year in cost. And in about 10 years' time, the two curves will cross. When they cross, there'll be a sea change, because at that point, it's economical, it's profitable to go solar, but not now. Solar power is about twice as expensive, depending upon how you count, more expensive than oil or coal. But in about 10 years' time, the two curves will cross. And even beyond that, fusion power becomes a possibility with NIF, which is located not too far from here in Livermore, California, and the French have the ITER in southern France. So by 2030, fusion power becomes an option where seawater is the basic fuel.
Very good. A little bit of switch here. What are your thoughts about the singularity concept? Ray Kurzweil has popularized this idea.
Well, let's be real. Our most advanced robots today, have the intelligence of a cockroach. A stupid cockroach. A lobotomized stupid cockroach. Our most advanced robots take 6 hours to walk across the room. Does that remind you of anybody you know? 6 hours to walk across the room. That's today. Now, you saw Jeopardy, where Watson, the IBM computer, beat two humans. And some people said, aha, pretty soon our robots are going to put us in zoos, make us dance behind bars. They'll throw peanuts at us. Well, think about it this way. Does the Watson computer that won the contest, does it even know that it won the contest? Did it celebrate? Was it aware that it won the contest? Or for that matter, can it do anything else except win contests involving Jeopardy? Watson is a one-trick pony. Chess-playing machines are one-trick ponies. Your calculator can calculate a million times faster than you. So we have the illusion that it's intelligent. But we know that a calculator is an adding machine. Watson is an adding machine. These robots are adding machines. Our brain is not an adding machine. The human brain is not a computer. Now, most people would say, now, wait a minute. Everybody says the brain is a computer. No, the brain is not a computer. The brain has no Windows. It has no operating system, no software, no programming, no Pentium chip, no software. I mean, the brain is not a computer. So what is it? It's a learning machine. It learns. It rewires itself after it learns. Now, your laptop today is just as stupid as it was yesterday. Your laptop never gets smarter. But that's all brains do. They just get smarter. So I think we have to push back the singularity. Mm-hmm. Maybe by mid-late century, then we do have to worry about these robots. And then I suggest, well, when I interviewed people in the artificial intelligence community, they tell me that there are three possibilities when robots become very smart. One possibility is to let them take over. There are some people who say that they are our children. If they want to put us in zoos, well, so be it. That's the law of evolution, survival of the fittest. Nah, I don't think so. The second possibility is to put a chip in their brain if they get too smart. Once they start to get as smart as, let's say, a mouse or a dog, cat, a monkey, then, yeah, they become dangerous. So we put a chip in their brain to shut them off, or we train Harrison Ford to go out there and fight these robots. The third possibility is advocated by Kurzweil, and that is merge with them. Now, merging with them is a little bit dicey, because maybe sometimes you don't want to have implants come dangling out of your head. I mean, ever try to look cool with implants coming out of your head? Okay. I would say that merging with robots is a possibility, but it has to be cool. Young people are going to have to want to do it. You're going to want to be attractive to other people. You're going to want to be with it. Because if you look like the Borg, I mean, forget it. You're going to be lonely on Friday night.
Well, excuse me. Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where we only have time for one more question. So let me read this audience question. Since you are one of the smartest people in New York City, have you been on Cash Cab?
That's hard. That's real hard.
You may need to think a while before you answer that one.
I'm sure you all enjoyed this program. It was so entertaining. So I would venture to say Dr. Kaku is not only one of the most intelligent people in New York, but interesting as well. So thank you very much for attending this program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. We would like to thank Dr. Michio Kaku, physics professor at New York University and author of Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. John Zipper, vice president of media and editorial at the Commonwealth Club. Our audience here in Palo Alto and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Yes. Thank you.